We'll now take verbal roll call. President Delmore.
Here.
Vice President Simon. Here. Secretary Abrahamian.
Here.
Alder Latimer Burris. Absent. Alder Vetiver.
Here.
Board Member Strozier.
Here.
Board Member Callisto. Excused. Board Member Witzinski. Excused. Chair, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Our first item is approval of the minutes from our last meeting. We have a motion to approve.
I'll move approval.
Okay, and do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, without objection, they are approved. Jody, do we have any public comment?
There are no registrants.
Okay. Board members, do we have any disclosures or recusals? Okay, seeing none, it looks like we can go to our first item, which is a presentation on effective salt management processes. And we have a number of presenters today, Joe Grandi, Charlie Romnes, and Allison Madison. And guess if presenters would like to come up for
Joe is
here. Okay.
I'll kick it all off. So I'll allow Allison and Charlie to introduce themselves, but I'll start with a brief introduction of both myself and the topic. So Water Resources Manager here at Madison Water Utility. And tonight we're gonna talk about,
you put up the presentation.
Yeah, I was gonna try to do it a different way, but I gotta go.
I got you.
In 3 seconds, it should be up.
So while she's doing that, tonight I'm going to be talking about effective salt management practices. I'll lead things off with a primer on road salt and the water cycle, followed by Allison from Wisconsin Saltwise, who'll talk about some of the impacts of road salt on the environment and some of the best management practices that can be employed to minimize that damage. Followed by Charlie from City Streets, who'll talk about the strategies and approaches that are currently being employed in the City of Madison. So with that, I'll jump right in, and thank you, Jody, for getting that up. Appreciate it. So we're here to talk about road salt, and very simply, road salt is a very simple chemical. It's made of sodium and chloride. They're ionically held together, but it's a fairly simple substance. And many of you are familiar with it because you sprinkle it on your French fries, but you also use it in your water softeners to soften your water for whatever purposes you might have for that. Like I said, it's a very simple compound, and when it's placed on the roads, sidewalks, and parking lots, it lowers the freezing temperature of the water. And that allows us to melt ice. So it's a de-icing agent, but also it's used for anti-icing. So you probably recognize those white strips on the road, that's brining or anti-icing that precedes the event to prevent some of that icing when we have that precipitation event. So
before you go to the next slide, Jody, you want to take the roll call again? Because the audience.
Yes, please. We will now take roll call again. President Delmore.
Here.
Vice President Simon.
Here.
Secretary Abrahamian.
Here.
Alder Latimer Burris.
Here.
Alder Vetiver.
Here.
Board Member Strozier.
Here.
Board Member Callisto excused. Board Member Witzinski excused.
So why are we talking about this today? Well, once we apply salt on the roads, on the sidewalks, on the parking lots, it basically doesn't go away. It doesn't evaporate. It doesn't break down. It simply gets washed away when the snow melts or the next spring storm when we have a rainfall event, and then that salt ends up in the lakes. It ends up on the soil surface and left to infiltrate or percolate down into groundwater. And so the impacts of this are well known here in the Madison area, in that the Madison lakes and groundwater have been showing significant increases in both sodium chloride levels, and they're directly related to road salt. And over the last 20 years, which I'll show in a second, the sodium and chloride levels have more than tripled in some of our wells. And so to levels that are fairly alarming, maybe not fully detectable by our residents yet, but getting pretty close to that level that is concerning. And then even though it does not significantly impact the deeper aquifer wells, they do show some signs of impact. So this next slide, many of you may have seen before, and this is just showing a greater than 50-year history of the chloride levels in the Yahara chain of lakes and what those impacts are. And you can see the impacts of road salt were noticeable even back in the late 60s and early 70s, where we were already seeing levels that were 20 to 40 milligrams per liter. We would typically expect those to be less than 10. And road salting, I believe, started in the 1950s here in the Madison area. But what we can see is that those levels in the lakes have more than tripled from that 20 milligram per liter level. And in a smaller water body like Lake Wingriff, for example, there's been a 6-time increase over that 50-year period. For us, looking at drinking water, this graph is showing the 25-year history of chloride levels at some of our wells. And those blue dots correspond to our well 14, which is on University Avenue down by Spring Harbor. And the red dots, the orange dots are well 6, which also on University Avenue. This is by the VA hospital. But what we notice is that the levels have, again, more than tripled. And particularly at well 14, we're approaching that secondary MCL. That's the level when a typical person might start to taste the impact of chloride and that saltiness in their water. So we're getting pretty darn close to that at well 14. And, you know, it really is a harbinger for what we would see at some of our other wells. You know, even though well 6 is about half the level at well 14, we can predict that 20 years out, that will be approaching the levels that we see at well 14. And there's other wells that are impacted that way. I also do show well 24 here just as an example to show that not all wells are going to be impacted, and well construction plays a big role in that as well. So with that brief introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Allison, who can talk about some of the best management strategies.
Thank you, Jody, for managing the slides, and thanks everyone.
It's deciding to take a break.
Okay, that's all right. So I'll just introduce myself for a moment. So Allison Madison, I'm the program manager at Wisconsin Saltwise, which is a program at the Capital Area Regional Planning Commission. So I'm housed here in Madison, but I do work statewide on this issue. So working to reduce salt pollution in lakes, streams, and drinking water. I do want to take a moment to I feel like my job is to advocate, right, for our water here, our fresh water, and to know, well, Joe, I feel like did a great job of explaining this is a real problem. I feel like also maybe normalized a little bit our use of salt. And I would say this is not good because water softeners, one, you know, are not used everywhere around the state. Water softeners here in the U.S. are used to soften water down to 0 grains per gallon. That removes all the water hardness. Most European countries say you can't do that. You can soften water a bit, kind of as needed. There are also many European countries. I have a student right now researching Germany, where in most cities in Germany, you cannot put water or salt on sidewalks. It's actually illegal to do that because they've said the salt goes into our water. We need to protect our water. So we've kind of become accustomed to pretty excessive use of salt and really need to be rethinking that in terms of protecting our freshwater resources. So you can go, yep, Jody. So up here, best management practices. One kind of cut off a little bit on the bottom is the use of liquids, making those lines down the storm, but there are down the street. There's a whole, you can see host here of practices that every individual, as well as obviously like agency that's using salt, needs to be considering. So brine is a part of smart salting. Equipment calibration is huge. continue to evaluate, how are we doing? Did we oversalt during this event? Did we undersalt? Like, what's really needed? So, and then evaluate or maybe communicate those level of service. So all of these things are part of all our Saltwise trainings and equipment workshops, open houses that happen across the state. Jody can go forward. So on behalf of our water, giving you just a little bit of an understanding, yes, we're seeing those chloride levels go up. Those are numbers. What does that really mean in our water? So this is the work of Bill Hintz from the University of Toledo. Bill and his students study this by literally sometimes taking buckets of water and then stream water, lake water, and all the little critters in them. And then they add a little bit of salt, a little more salt, you know, and watch what happens. So one of the first organisms to be impacted by elevated levels of salt are the zooplankton. So over on that left side, I know there's a lot going on this screen, you see that X over zooplankton. Those tiny little critters we don't think much of, but play an important role in the ecosystem of our lakes, are the first to be impacted when chloride levels get to 50. So again, remember Joe said naturally we're between 0 and 10. When we get up to 50, starts to pull some more sensitive creatures out of that ecosystem. So zooplankton turn into little pickles. A cucumber in salt water, you make a pickle. Dead pickles mean there's less food going up the food chain. Dead pickles also don't eat a lot of algae. So that means our lakes get greener and murkier. So you see that little picture on the far right, that's a bucket of stream water where salt was added. It's starting to get kind of green, increased algal biomass. And then also there's those direct impacts, just like salt is a stressor on our cardiovascular system. It also impacts freshwater organisms. So you can see those tiny little fingerling trout, the one in the high road salt bucket, didn't grow as well. So reduced rates of growth, reduced rates of reproduction, higher susceptibility to parasites. So Jody, you can move along. So that's what's happening in our lakes. Oh no, we lost the animation here. Okay, that's all right. Can you pull it up? Okay, all right, awesome. We're back in business, thank you. So, yeah, we lost animation on the last one, but this one is really important. So this next slide is going just a little deeper into what we see in our drinking water when we add salt. So unfortunately, salt, as Joe said, we have these ions, sodium and chloride, and they like to interact with other ions. So not to go like too deep into the chemistry, like I used to be a chemistry teacher, so I kind of nerd out with this a little bit, but how many of you have water softeners in your basements? Okay, so you put salt in, right? And you know what it pulls out? Put sodium in your water and it's pulling out
calcium
and magnesium, right? Which come from the calcium carbonate, the limestone, right? That your water is sitting in. So your water sits in calcium carbonate and calcium magnesium carbonate. When it comes up, you want to pull those calcium magnesium ions out because you don't want them to reform that rock by, right? In your faucets and in your pipes. And so you switch, there's ion exchange. So this is going to actually illustrate how that same ion exchange is also happening, pause for a second there, in our soils, in our bedrock, and sometimes in our pipes as well. So the higher rates of salt, higher levels of salt from the Flint River contributed to the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan. And this is how that works. So in our soils, clay particles hold on to positively charged ions. So anything with a plus. So I've got K plus, that's potassium. Can you go back, Jody, just one? So I got potassium and manganese there being held in the soil. So this happens in our rocks, thank you, in our soils, also in our pipes where we have metal ions, okay? So then when stormwater comes through, Jody, we got the sodium and the chloride, they've just split apart. And if our clay particles are negative, what part of the salt are they going to hold on to? The positive part, right? The sodium. So what happens then is those clay particles can only hold on to so much, so many positive things, right? And so, Jody, next animation there, some of the other stuff, some of the other positively charged ions, other metals, go through. And then, Jody, the chloride negative goes through. So we've kind of reduced the fertility of our soils, also made them more erodible, but we've also changed what's in the soil solution and then headed to groundwater, right? So what we see now is that potassium and manganese is our water, and this is what started coming out of people's taps in the Maryland area after a pretty heavy salt use winter. So Sujay Kaushal, University of Maryland, has studied this. Him and his team have actually coined the term freshwater salinization syndrome. and how that it creates chemical cocktails. So it's not just that sodium and chloride are increasing in our water, but it's driving the release of other metals, sometimes even radionuclides, into our water. So the biogeochemistry of this gets a little bit more complex, right? So next. So what are we doing? So salt-wise, working around the state to educate any agency, any contractors, organizations that are putting large quantities of salt down. So 8 different trainings last year with County Highway Department staff, a number with school districts, universities, et cetera, all across the state, touched over 1,000 industry professionals with those trainings. The picture on the left there is actually from Pittsburgh, their shop, where we had a lot of local municipalities come. So we're getting people to come to talk about this. One, people need to think about it, right? And be talking about salt, we're gonna see changes. And we're getting people, I wanna say, like, becoming pretty passionate about the picture of Corey Teets from Eau Claire on the right. Like, people are getting excited about the reductions that they're making. So you're gonna hear the city of Madison's dropped salt use about 40%, right, Charlie? Really incredible. We're seeing people drop salt use between 30 to upwards, like over 50%. Jefferson County's dropped their salt use 75% in the last kind of 5-ish years compared to the previous 10 years. So, a lot of reductions are possible. Yep, you're good, Jody. So so working with those agencies is a part of a slice of the pie here, right? But there are also a lot of barriers that need to be addressed. One of them is public perception. So trying to get the word out, I think doing that in the Madison area, a lot of signs, shovel more, salt less, kind of a lot of newsletters, through various resources, including, you know, a lot of utility here, we're going to get the message out. Winter Salt Week has been a big thing that's growing across the country. So Jody, you can go on to the next thing. Funding. So I'm kind of going backwards here on that list. So I actually worked with the governor's office, and I don't know if anyone noticed this, but there's $5 million earmarked in the executive budget for road salt equipment investments, upgrades. So what we see is a small kind of one-time investment in some equipment can really pay off long-term. But sometimes, you know, it's hard to get the approval for those funds. So this is modeled after the H2 Ohio fluoride reduction grant program that last year put over $4 million out to municipalities. So we're trying to see, could we get something like that going, and would love to have some support on that. Make sure we keep that in the budget. Thanks, Jody. And then the last thing, or the first thing on my list, is liability. So lots of successes on the public side. On the private side, that fear of liability continues to drive a lot of oversalting. So we introduced a bill last session, actually got it passed through the Senate and the Assembly, but it's real hard to get across the finish line. The governor did veto it after hearing a lot from the trial lawyers. So yeah, you can imagine, but the state of New Hampshire has had liability protections in place for 10 years now. They've had a program called the Green Snow Pro, and it protects contractors to get certified in best practices and utilize those and document what they do. All right. So kind of next steps, actually, I think 2025 there for this year, continuing to work on the Saltwater Certified Contractor Program. So kind of revamping what the city has done to make sure that anybody who goes to the training, then their companies really adopt best practices. It's not enough to just come and learn about practices. We really want to understand what you're doing on the ground. And also getting more of the word out, trying to bring more of the property managers to the table as well, so that their contracts can be set up to really promote the use of best practices versus time and material contracts that just incentivize oversalting. So easy collaborations, if you're intrigued and you want to support this work, we have webinars almost monthly. Some of them are Saltwater success stories. Others are some of the scientists like Sujay Kashal, Bill Hintz, I referenced earlier. We also have a quarterly newsletter to kind of stay up to date. The most up to date would be following our social media. And I do have my email up there as well. We are a little bit though in need of funding for 2026 and beyond. So that would be, I don't know, what the Water Utility Board could do to support that, or maybe talk with other water utility boards across the state, as right now it's 39% of public drinking water wells in the state have surpassed 20 milligrams per liter, which is a threshold the EPA has set for people who are supposed to be on a low sodium diet. Your value should be, sodium levels in your water should be below that. So it's not just a Madison problem. It is something we're seeing across the state. Again, it says $5, but $5 million grant program, that would really support a lot of municipal investments, thinking about other ways to kind of expand the reach of this. So I thank you for your time, and I think we'll take questions later if there are any. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to keep walking right now. Don't want to... All right, my name is Charlie Romines. I'm the Streets and Urban Forestry Superintendent for the City of Madison. Been in that role since January of 18. That salt going into a truck. Go ahead, Jody. This is not a new problem. This has been in the news in Madison since the late 70s. A really large policy change was made at that point, really kind of bifurcating essentially streets in the city, salt routes and residential or non-salt routes in order to try and bring down the amount of salt used within the city of Madison. For those that aren't aware, the salt route network in the city is now about 45-46% of our roadways. The rest is non-salt route. So those roads get plowed at 3 inches or above and then get sand applied, which is about 5% salt in there to keep the sand from freezing and binding. This is not just a unique to Madison problem. This is a smattering of headline grabs over mostly over the last 2 or 3 years from across the country and parts of the of our states that get snow and ice. So this is something that is being grappled with really across the country where anywhere salting is included. This is our fair city and some of the surrounding. We're not the only ones who apply salt. Here in the gold and yellow, that's our salt route network. The green is the university. Other municipalities are just grayed out, but then you can see we're Dane County Highway. Anything in blue, light blue, otherwise, that's Dane County Highway. So they are a significant participant salting in our community as well. That will salt a lot of fries. That is one of our three barns. It is the largest of the three, but that's what that looks like. That gentleman there is my height, about 6'4". So that's a lot. Go ahead. So as I explained a little bit earlier, this is another representation of our salt routes and where they are. Primarily, you're looking at metro bus routes, roads near schools, emergency services like hospitals, police, fire, any of the major thoroughfares, which again, pretty much encompass anything that's going to have a metro bus route on it anyway. The metro bus system drives a significant portion of our salt route network, but not exclusively so. When we go out and we go salting, typically that first round will take 2.5 to 3+ to get around. It'll depend a lot on time of day. And then subsequent rounds can take 3.5 to 4.5 to get around because that involves going back to the shop, getting loaded back, getting back out on route. And so it just takes more time to get around. Not always the biggest deal in the world, but it does come up at times where that's an issue for us. Go ahead. As Joe had mentioned earlier, here's our anti-icing, the pencil lines, if you will, in the street. This is something we really started picking up on. We've done it for a number of years. We really started picking up about 4 or 5 years ago, more significantly. So conditions still have to be right to allow this to be done. One thing we changed 3 or 4 years ago, there's two reasons you would do this. One, the idea would be that you would use less salt when you get a storm event because that snow and ice shouldn't bond to the pavement in the same way. And so it certainly can break that bond, but then, like I said, it only works if you actually then use less salt. And so for us, what we started doing about 2 or 3 years ago is, except in extreme circumstances, when we put this brine down, instead of going out at kind of a standard rate, which is 300 pounds per lane mile, we go at 200. So we're actually reducing the amount of salt by about 40 pounds per lane mile on that first run and sometimes the second, versus putting this out and then still going out at 300. Really what you've done is added more salt. Now, perhaps it's a little more effective in breaking that bond, but you're putting more down. So we've seen some pretty good results with that. So again, we're kind of trying to work, you know, the edges where we can here to get our salt use down. Go ahead. So here, again, equipment calibration. This is something we do before each season. And then, although this year was a lot of slow time, typically in the winter, we will have a time where it will slow down a little bit and we will pull in equipment and recalibrate mid-season to make sure it's still in place. In the bottom right, salt scales that we put in place a few years ago to make sure we know what we're putting down with a higher level of certitude, and talk about that here in a little bit. And then also in the bottom left, that's a saltwise training that some of our staff is going through. That's my bad. Last thing I would mention, that last slide, you don't have to take it back, we've done two audits of our routes in my time in Madison to make sure that the salt route network actually adheres to our policy. Things tend to grow and creep and add over time. And we have dropped the salt route from 855 miles to 778 in this winter. So that's a 9% reduction. So that's, you know, in whatever winter is going to bring you, we'll use just 9% less salt right off the jump because 9% less of the roadways are salted. So that's good. And that has, again, been about 2/3 from our route audits and about 1/3 from the Metro redesign from a couple of years ago. I'm sure many of you are aware they changed how they provide service quite a bit, and quite a few of our roads that were salted as part of being Metro bus routes are no longer bus routes and don't meet any of the other criteria. All right, still some things we're working on. So a bit of a example of what Allison mentioned with a live edge blade. These can be a little bit tricky. You know, one of the things doing a city streets versus like county roads and highways, we have manhole covers, we have water utility repairs, we have all kinds of imperfections in our streets that you don't see on like the Beltline or on certain county roads and highways. And so one of the things that has always been a struggle then is getting as much with the plow as we can. This is the second time in my tenure we've tried a bit of what would be called a live edge blade. This one is in 12 1-foot segments, and they can all articulate and what's called trip separately. So if let's say a manhole cover is on the right side, you know, one or two of those will hit that cover and basically flex back and trip. Now, it dumps the snow, but it doesn't tear up the plow. And it allows the other 10 sections, if you will, to ride more closely to the edge of the road. And so we have one of those this year, and we haven't done a lot of plowing until 2 weeks ago. We finally really got to put it to some good use. The operators love it because it reduces the chatter and the vibration they get quite a bit. So that's something we're going to continue to work on and see if it's something that makes sense. If we are in fact seeing more snow removed by the blade, the snow blades will never remove all of the snow. That's not how it works. But if we can do better, then that's that much less salt we need to put down to melt it. On the right there, that was a new. So in-ground pavement temperatures and ground temperature monitors are nothing new. This was something we tried starting a couple years ago. The idea was that it was supposed to monitor not just ground temperature at three different depths. Ground temperature is something very important to us when deciding how and when and how much salt to put down. It was supposed to measure, and notice I say supposed to measure, indicating it has not worked, the salinity of the solution at the road surface. And the idea there was it would give us a good idea of how much salt we still had working. Plus then with the ground temperatures and the looking at forecasts, we could have a better idea of, do we need to put more down? How much more do we put down? Or do we just need to wait with what we have here to let it interact and work? They do great at telling us what the road temperatures are. The rest of it hadn't really worked, but not everything you try works. We have a new one. We're hoping to get it out this winter. That's actually mounted to, I wanted to do it on buses. It didn't work out. Wanted to get it on, we're gonna look at getting it on our plows. That is, so it'd be a not on the plow, on the plow truck mounted. That is supposed to do some of the same things. So it got lawyered up. So hopefully maybe by next winter, we'll get it all through that and we'll be able to give that a go and see if it gives us some of the information we'd hope to get out of here. Again, not everything new you try works, but that's okay. Next slide, please. So this is what a salt route's eventually supposed to look like. This is salt, time, temperature, and traffic. That's kind of where we hope to get to. Sometimes events expire, transpire, and go ahead, Jody, and we wind up with something that looks more like that. That is a secondary salt route, and that's what happens when temperatures get below what we can salt. We go to a sand mix. Sand generally works okay on residential streets and streets with low volumes, but as we saw last winter, you put them out on significant roads within 30 minutes to an hour, it doesn't look like it's been sanded. And people, last winter, for example, in that 1 9-day stretch, we put more sand out on Madison roads than we put out on every winter since I've been the street superintendent. But yet we got lots of complaints of, why didn't you put sand out on the roads? Those busier streets between wind and cars whirring past and tracked off with tires, it doesn't work on busy streets for traction. It just doesn't stay put. Go ahead, please. And then this is what our residential streets, like this is what we're looking for most of the time on residential streets. That's no salt. And that's just gonna kind of stay there until sun and temperature do its thing. Go ahead. Thank you. So one of the new things we put in place for this year, so those of you who were here last winter will recall, we had that, you know, depending on where you were in the city, 9.5 to 11.5, 12 inches of snow, temperatures dropped out. And we just didn't have the ability to get the roads down to a condition we would have liked to have them in before the temperatures dropped out. And part of that is a limitation of just having access to rock salt. So rock salt, again, depending on a number of factors, will work at the levels we will put it down, anywhere from 18 degrees and above. That can shift a little bit based on cloudy, sunny, what your ground temps are, that type of thing. This magnesium chloride will work down into single digits, you know, again, some room at 6 to 9 degrees. And so we bought just enough of this so we could put 2 rounds down in the city. So the idea is this is kind of break glass in case of emergency. So if we someday, it could be next year, it could be 10 years from now, we'll get into a similar situation as we had last winter, rather than only have the option to sand and sand and sand, kind of when the event ends, if we land the plane where we did last year, we'd be able to put this out. And we should be able to at least get those main routes down to at least kind of 2 tracks with pretty clear intersections, which should handle about 90% of the, you know, issues people were having. So this stuff is not cheap. And it is also not awesome for the environment or your cars or buses. So it's not something we would, even if we had the money, we would want to put out on a regular and routine basis. But to have it as an option when we really need it, I think it makes good sense. Go ahead. And then the point Allison made. So in these past 5-6 winters, we've been down to about 8,200 tons of salt on average. From 2008 through 2013, we averaged about 13,000 tons of salt a year. And the salt that we put out on our roadways can take a lot of years, it can take decades to show up in the groundwater in the wells. So some of the, you know, some of that salt we see on those slides could have been put down as far as 20, 30 years ago. It just depends on the structure of the soil and how kind of access it has to get into the groundwater. And I think that's, is there one more slide? Just the, The other thing I would point out, so we continue to try and have more information and answers available for where we salt, how we salt, with our GIS individual, Corey Stoutner, and with the scales and combined, we just were able to pull up for the Lake Wingrove watershed. So I had mentioned before kind of how we were, you know, monitoring salt, pulling salt routes out. So in the Lake Wingrove watershed, we reduced the salt lane miles in there from 68 and a half to, we'll say, 64 and a half over the past 3 years. And that's with adding in 0.7 miles from the town of Madison coming in. I promise you, the watershed is better off with us salting than the town. The idea there is then we can apply, you know, we know with the scales how much salt we're putting down for each event. With our GPS system, we know how much time the trucks are on those salt routes within that geofence. So we're actually going to be able to tell to a very high degree of certainty how much salt we're putting into the Lake Wingerwald watershed. We're going to figure that out here. Next project will be Wellhead 14. So anywhere, anything we can kind of geofence, we're going to be able to say, here's our salt lane miles, and then applying the number of salt routes we made, how much salt that truck put out, and be able to, with a really high degree of certainty, be able to say, here's how much salt we put in this particular area of concern that someone would have with some type of lead. That's all I have.
Questions for our presenter?
Can I? Sure. Stephen, thank you. Oliver, you mentioned, can you get a basically together on road salting. So I gathered the three best experts I know, so they are here for all of you.
Thank you for the presentation. I just, you know, over the last several years, we've gotten less snow. We're continuing to get less snow this year. I don't even know if we've gotten 10 inches.
19.
Okay, so it feels like less.
I agree.
But I guess how much of that is a factor into how much we're salting? Not salting.
Sure. That's a great question. It's one of the reasons, bluntly, with some of the results Madison work the city is doing, I refuse to allow the streets division to be measured by per inches of snow. When snow falls, like snow in March is different than December. Dry snow is different than wet, and on and on and on and on. Oftentimes, it can take, we put just as much salt down on a 3/4 inch event as we do 2 or 3 inch. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. That's why, you know, bluntly, I feel like one of the best measures we have is what is our salt route network. That's why I wanted to, you know, share the information. If we reduce that salt route network by 9%, even though one winner looks like the water bottle and one winner looks like my phone, the one thing we know is we put 9% down than we would have. Right, as a starting point. But it is really, really hard to pin down how much. There is no solid answer for how much salt you should put down per inch of snow. The key is, are you doing all the best practices that you can? And are you honestly just being hyper diligent? Because in Madison, we walk a razor's edge, bluntly, to put down as little salt as possible. That doesn't mean we always get it right, but we are on the edge. Because believe me, a lot of us would sleep better at night in the short term to just open it up, put a bunch of salt down, run water, go home and go to bed. But that's not what we do. So I'm certainly comfortable. Like if you look at our numbers starting in like 2013, there is a massive shift and the amount of salt the streets division was putting down. And that was really, some of that in the early stages was the work of Steve Schultz. Steve's now retired, God bless him. But we've put in much more of a, you know, much more systemically based, you know, practices and procedures now. So it's not based on one person's force of will and guru-ness to make sure we're walking that fine line. But certainly we will use less snow in 19 inches than we will 39 or 79.
I would just add a couple of things if you're curious to know a little bit more. Wisconsin DOT does put together a winter weather severity index, and that's a way that they try to understand kind of trying to normalize, you know, various winters. A lot of factors go into that. I definitely would say, you know, Dane County, Charlie mentioned, you know, one of the other salters in the region, you know, if their salt use has only gone down by 20 to 25%, and then next door, Jefferson County, so it's gone down by 75%, it's kind of like, winters haven't been, you know, too different across the county line there. Maybe there's some more room for opportunity for salt reductions. And also on the contractor side, while we've had less snow, like I talked to a lot of contractors, you know, a couple weeks ago, 19 salting events, 2 plowing events. So they're just going out and salting only because there's not really enough snow to plow, right? So that's their like response.
Other questions?
I have a couple of questions. My first question is, when you said pencil lines on the street, so the goal is just to get 2 empty lines for traffic, is that what it is? I mean, what is the pencil lines on the street?
Okay, so the pencil lines are the anti-icing or brining. Sometimes they'll refer to it as brining. And so the idea there is those salt lines prevent when that snow and comes down from it bonding as well with the pavement. So by preventing that bond, you can use less salt to get a better result.
Okay.
Because without that, it kind of just like a pan with no Teflon, the stuff just sticks. And how much harder is it to, you know, so somewhat similar to that.
Okay. And then my other question was, I was really interested to know, I don't know why, but how does that measuring device work? The one that kind of looks like a tube, if you could just go back.
Oh, sure, yeah, the ground sensor.
Yes.
Sure.
How does it work?
So, yeah. Oh. So that goes in, it's cored out and goes into the road. And so at the top of the tube there, there's actually a little cap that would be there. That is the actual sensor that was supposed to give us the IP, the measurement of salinity. It would tell you if it was wet, which it tells you if it's wet, it would tell you if it was icy, and it would tell you it was supposed to be able to measure how much salt you had mixing in with the in solution at that top, which would be right at the road surface. And then the rest of that, all that was buried underneath and essentially giving you temperatures at the surface, 3 inches, and then at 9 inches. It does fine with the temperatures. It will tell you if it's wet. It will tell you if it's icy, but it's just has not worked in any kind of like giving us how much salinity or salt is there, which was for us like the big idea. Like if we know exactly how much we have there, we know the weather that's coming in the next few hours, that can really inform us like, how much do we need to put down or can we not put down any with much greater level of certitude. It doesn't work in that respect, bluntly.
Well, I appreciate this. It's a serious business. This is my second salt, if you will, seminar, because I have the airport commission and they walk us around. And it's really amazing all the work that you guys do and how they become almost like weather people where they have it down to a science. So we do appreciate it. I appreciate it. I do want to make one comment, and I wonder if the general public even knows that the 3 goals that you showed us, is that what that's what it's supposed to look like? In other words, if you'll go back to that picture of the three streets.
Yeah.
If so, I think you guys hit this a lot, and I wonder if the kind of with is that people don't understand this is what we're trying to get to that third picture.
The vast,
yes.
Vast majority of the complaints, reported problems we get in the winter in streets have to do with people misunderstanding and maybe ultimately disagreeing with what our service level standards are. They would see that and say, we want bare pavement. You messed up.
Yeah.
Or the salt route that gets to bare pavement there, they're like, why does it take so long? Because bluntly, the county gets to bare pavement before we do. They use more salt. And they get out, they can make rounds faster than us. So we are typically 6 to 10 hours behind where the county is as far as getting down to bare pavement. And that largely comes down to policy and somewhat to capability. But the vast majority is just people disagreeing, especially see it where districts bump up to other communities that do salt everything. We've got several neighborhoods in the community where like it might share space with Verona, and when you cross over, or Fitchburg, more, and it's like, what happened? Like, well, they salt their residential streets and we don't.
So maybe we can, you know, not that people watch city council, but it'd be interesting to constantly through the winter say, you know, remind us this is what we're shooting for, because
what we're shooting for.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you.
Sure.
Other questions or comments? And Allison, you mentioned water softeners, and I was at a MMSD sewer authority, and if I remember correctly, they were under some orders to reduce the amount of salt because our water softeners, if I'm thinking correctly on this, goes into the sewer system. Does that also have an impact on the wells?
Not on the wells, because they're discharging downstream, but they receive 100,000 pounds of salt a day, and it all goes downstream. So they do not have the capacity to remove that salt. They are running a pilot program right now with the city of Middleton. Residents can get a free blending valve to allow some of the hard water to go through. So before, remember I said at the very beginning, our water softeners are set to remove all of the hardness, so down to 0 grains per gallon. If you live in Milwaukee, you drink Lake Michigan water. That's at 8 grains per gallon. Okay, so if in Madison it's at 25 and you want to bring it down, do you need to bring it down to 0, or could you bring it down to 8? It's kind of like buying an AC unit, putting it in your window, and it's set to cool down to 50. Do you need that? Maybe you want some cooling, right? But like 50 degrees. So that's one of the, I'm going to say, partial solutions to at least somewhat reduce the total salt being there.
Is it possible that a city ordinance could set a standard closer to the optimized standard?
Yeah, we could definitely, that would definitely be an option there. Like I said, there are a lot of European countries, they don't allow softening down to 0. My aunt lives in California. They do not allow water softeners because water is something they don't take for granted. so looking at some options there.
Any other questions? Not? Thank you all very much.
Yeah, thank you. Really good.
And our next item, Ben, is authorizing a non-compete purchase.
Good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, I just want to just start by thanking Alder Latimer Burris and Alder Bittever for sponsoring this request to purchase a Valframe skid, which is a tool or piece of equipment that we use to exercise our valves. And I think I've, it kind of explains the background and information in the attachments that we did here. So I guess I'll just open it up for questions if anybody would like, you know, more detail on what this does or why do we use it and or anything.
Questions on this? The explanation is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, we've been using these for many, many years. Yeah.
And so if we do not have any questions or comments, is there a motion to approve the request? Anybody have a second?
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The one lucky guy.
Okay. And our next item is the Water Production Monthly Report. Joe?
Yeah. Okay, let's see. All right, we'll jump right into it. This is the monthly water production report. I think you guys are all familiar with the format, so I don't think I need to go over that, but we'll start with the left-hand side of the chart, and which basically shows that we have a regional surplus in all four regions. So doing great, typically do very well in January. This is a low demand period. You can see in that chart, the average daily production is about 23 million gallons per day. It's a very low number. shifting over to the right, looking where we are for the month of January or year to date through January 31st, we're virtually the same as we were last year. So about 700 million gallons for the first month of the year. Really not much more to say than that. Drilling down a little deeper, so in attachment B, this gives us a little bit more depth. So looking at the individual wells within the within those four regions, and what you'll note is that in regions A and B, or let me take one step back. So in each of those regions, we're only utilizing in total between 32 and 41% of the available capacity that we have. So very low on our utilization. Again, this is just a very low demand month. Just understanding that for the first half of the month, the college kids aren't here, and that really does have a significant impact on our water demand. It does pick up when they come back. But then looking specifically at regions A and B, in addition to our utilization being less than 40%, each of the wells is less than 50%. And that's our goal, right? But when we look at regions C and D, we do see that there are a few wells that are in that 50 to 60% range. And that largely reflects the fact that we do have some wells currently out of service. And so there's a little bit more demand or a little bit more work being expected of the wells that are making up for that. As we go through the year, those numbers will moderate, and I expect that they'll be below 50%, or if they're not below 50%, pretty close to it. In total, 720 million gallons for the system and 39% utilization. Happy to take questions or comments if you have any.
Questions? Thank you. Financial report, January.
I'll start with a little summary of January 31st, 2025. So far, water revenue are down by 247,000 compared to budget. Pumpage was also down during this time period. Our January operating fund balance, we're looking at 15.1 million. And our capital fund expenditure is 1.7 million, of which 1.5 million is encumbrances, leaving us with a capital fund balance of 1.3 million. Then our MADCAP data summary, as of February 19th, we have received a total of 777 applications. We have approved 514 and disapproved 263. Total household newly enrolled in conservation as of February is 161 households. And with that, we'll go to the bread and butter here. So this is very preliminary, but I have the estimated subject to change until audit financial statements are issued, 2024 numbers. So total revenues for 2024, I'm projecting, estimating we're going to end up at 53.3 million. That includes sales of water, other revenues, and interest income. Expenditure wise, we're looking at about 44.7 million. You can see about 19 is operating expenses, and then about another 19 million for debt services and payment, along with 6.82 million for pilot payment. And so with that, our ending fund balance, we're looking at just about 15.1 million for 2024. For construction fund, we're expecting 21.1 million. As you can see, we took out the GO bond borrowing. So that was 7.328 million. That was for Will 19. We also received 1.7 million in safe drinking water loan proceed, and then our 5 million in expense depreciation, along with transfer from our reserves, that makes up the 21.1 million. Total 2024 expenditures and encumbrances, we're looking at 23.7 million. So
That does leave our net construction fund balance at a negative 2.5 million. With our carryover from prior year, we are estimating $2 million in ending fund balance for 2020. And with that, as of January, total revenue is 4 million, you can say. And total expenditure is 3.2 million, leaving us with a net operating fund of 723,000. With our carryover, our anticipated carryover, our ending fund balance for operating would be 15.1 million. Then with construction fund, total revenues, we're looking at just shy of a million. Total capital expenditures and encumbrances is 1.7. And so our ending fund balance is 1.3 million to date.
With that, we can go on now to our cash reserves and long-term debt. So
a question on that page.
Yes.
So the big difference between the 25 budget and the projected 25 is the safe drinking water loan proceeds. It goes from $800,000 to $5 million. And I think that's well 12, if I remember seeing something later. Is that when you do the projected column, is that we're going to be applying? Is that fairly likely?
The state safe drinking water loan?
Yes.
Our assessment that it is likely because it's a facility loan. As opposed to L19, which was for treatment of secondary contaminants, so we are hopeful we should get that.
Then, with our cash reserve, as of January 31st, we're looking at a total cash and investment of 55.6 million, which right now, because we're only 1 month in, it gives us about 5.28 months of expenditures covered by our operating reserves. And with that, is there any questions?
So just for clarification, that will reduce over time,
yep.
What you're saying. Okay. I'm sure.
Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, January.
Yeah.
And we now have our capital project report.
Great. Good evening. So, got my mini agenda there. I'll go through finance numbers related to our expenditures for the first month of the year. Quick update on our very preliminary progress on expense depreciation for the year, and some major capital project updates of two that are underway and one that we are working towards getting underway. So again, kind of looking at some financials here, actual expenditures, pretty low to start the year, particularly with pipelines. We don't do a lot of winter pipeline work, especially in January. Freezing condition, but looking at the water main expense depreciation, the next slide, again, we've got a $5 million target specifically for water mains replacement or rehabilitation. And again, our actual expenditures are basically immaterial for the month of January. Ed noted, though, just as a kind of harbinger of future anticipated expenditures, you know, we've encumbered over $600,000 of pipeline, which is essentially locking in contracts for replacement work as construction picks up this spring. If we continue with some warm weather like we're having this week, it'll be sooner than later. But looking ahead, I feel like we're on target to spend up to that goal before the end of the year. So. Well 19, under construction, at the time of making this slide, we're having preparations for setting the treatment tanks, getting those installed. That was done at the beginning of this week. Those are set on the pads, which is the which are poured into the floor of the addition. The rest of the week has been spent with that same crane that lifted the tanks, setting now the precast walls and ultimately the roof building around those tanks that are set to kind of complete the shell of the building addition that they'll continue to kind of work on and And once enclosed, start to work on the interior a little more seriously too. So pay requests coming up. As I'd mentioned, you know, once the interior is a little more sealed for the addition part, they'll start more mechanical, electrical, and plumbing work there. They've already begun some mechanical work on the existing building too, which I'll kind of show a little bit of that in the next slide, which is just a couple of pictures. This is the tanks, which were just stored on the site, removed earlier this week. I can have some follow-up pictures next week of them in their current resting places, their permanent wheel resting places in the new addition. They didn't move very far from where they're stationed there once the crane lifted them. It's just kind of behind that view of the tanks there, 16 of them on two 8 tank skids. So the picture on the right is a look into our existing building. Kind of hard to see from that main line that sort of goes overhead of the workers there, but there is three pumps, or there used to be three pumps down there, which have since been disassembled and removed and will be replaced with new piping valves and pumps as part of this work too. So some updates on our kind of existing piping and infrastructure inside there. Picture's worth a thousand words, so I'll say too much there. Well 15, under very similar milestones right now. Earlier this month, the filter tanks there were set, and they put the now permanent roof back on. They're doing some final attachments there, and we'll be getting into very similar work related to piping connections, a lot of equipment, electrical work forthcoming. It's going to be quite a bit now that they're sealed up. It's going to be all interior work that we're looking forward to getting started with. Hopefully next month we'll be rehabbing the deep well and the borehole so that it's ready to go back into production when the filter tanks are ready to be utilized. So again, just I thought were some pretty interesting pictures shown here. These are basically on the left, that is directly outside of the building there. You can kind of use the crane boom for reference there, but this is the day the crane basically picked up all four tanks, set them on the inside there. They're just out there today. A lot less space than you see in the picture on the right. Those are large tanks, and you can kind of see the square or diamond-shaped pedestals there where the tanks, each of their 4 feet, end up resting. So you can kind of visualize how the space quickly gets consumed. Roof is back on now. It looks dramatically different. I hope to never see this facility quite like this again in my career, and we've got some good permanent treatment there installed. So good progress there. Well 12, we're in the planning stages right now. We had a good meeting with our design consultant, particularly with electrical plan upgrades. A lot of the design concepts for rebuilding, repiping, repumping, everything are largely the same. We're coming up on almost 10 years of kind of modern electrical equipment and codes, though, so they saw some good opportunities to make some updates there, which we discussed, and we're looking forward to implementing. They're also doing some, finalizing some modeling analysis for potential added site storage out there, and we'll have a recommendation maybe for the board by next month on how we'd like to proceed with that, and then roll up plans and specs for the safe drinking water loan application by the end of June. Still targeting construction beginning next year and being completed in 2027. And we'll work with our consultant on getting them on board for kind of that complete project journey in the coming months as well. Currently, their contract goes through this planning and analysis stage. So we'll dovetail those two things and hopefully have a complete project timeline. So those are my updates this month. Happy to take questions.
Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Operations report.
Again, quite in a session.
Yeah, I won't be brief on this. Obviously, when you look at these numbers, we've been spending quite a bit of time repairing main breaks. We had 70 in January alone, and then I believe we're currently up to about 58 February. So those 2 months are usually the worst months we have in the year. And so we've been concentrating on that. So you, I guess another thing I'll point out is the hydrant inspections. We have a new hydrant inspector who's starting in that role. And so obviously you can see the numbers are down for inspections of hydrants. And another reason for that is we have 200 plus RP valves that we hang on hydrants over the warmer months. Actually, we have them on there all year round if they keep them warm, to protect the water from customers who need temporary water connection for construction projects and so forth. The state requires that we test those every year. So usually the hydrant inspectors wisely choose the coldest time of the year to test all those valves and submit reports to the state. So that's why you see that that number is down. Obviously we didn't do any flushing. And the other thing I'll point out is that we do have crews out still exercising our valves. We had over 1800 valves that were inspected and operated in the system. I guess that's, obviously didn't do any ditch repair past month. So anybody have any questions about the numbers? Or?
Just to recognize that work your crew do under really tough conditions. So it's appreciated.
Thank you. Yeah, they do a great job.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We now have public information, Marcus.
Yep. Hello, everyone. Marcus Pearson, public information officer. It's kind of weird. I'm not going to take a lot of time just because I know this information is a bit redundant to what our chief engineer, Pete Holmgren, shared. However, I do like to give kind of a qualitative storytelling twist to some of the milestones and some of the water utility highlights from more of a like public perspective. So if you all know, especially at this point after Pete's report, that back in May of 2024, we broke ground on a PFAS treatment facility at Well 15. It's a huge milestone that was just reached this February, I think February 5th, to be exact, when the GAC or the Grand the GAC and the IX tanks were delivered to the well site. And as you can imagine, these media tanks are fundamentally the most important component of the entire project, as they are responsible for removing the PFAS and other volatile organic compounds like PCE or TCE, which is really important to remove from the well or from the water pumped at Well 15. But really, when you think about it, this treatment system, one of the first of its kind in Wisconsin, is expected to remove all the PFAS down to a non-detectable level while simultaneously removing other volatile organic compounds, as I mentioned, like perchloroethylene and trichloroethylene. But something that really is interesting about this project is it has been a long journey over 8 years at this point. So that's why the GAC or the granular activated carbon and the ion exchange tanks being delivered is truly a huge project milestone. Back in 2017, PFAS were first discovered at Well 15. Again, that was over 8 years ago. So this has been an ongoing kind of project. And to get to this point where you really see the tanks there is very impressive. And thank you to Jody for taking some great pictures and being out there on the site. I was also out there that day. It was really cool to see the tanks being airlifted. I didn't expect them to be that huge either. So that's pretty crazy. But so 2017, we first discovered this. 2018, we completed a modeling and groundwater study. The study confirmed that Truex airfield is inside the groundwater capture zone for Well 15 and could be and most likely is the source of PFAS at the well. You can actually read more about this groundwater study on our website. It's actually on the project page if you're interested in that. So then 2019, actually 2 years later, we actually shut the well down amid community concerns and growing concerns, throughout that Northeast side community about PFAS chemicals. And we made a promise as a utility and as a city to the community to not operate the well until treatment was implemented. So thinking back in 2018 and 2019, saying we will not turn this well back on until treatment is implemented. And then,
7 years later, we finally can see the tank center. We know this is really happening. So that's why this is such a big milestone. 2021, we completed a feasibility study to determine the effectiveness of the granular activated carbon or the GAC at removing the mixture of PFAS found at Well 15 and what it would cost. And you can also read more about that feasibility study on our website as well, if you're interested. Then in 2022, we hired an engineering consultant to develop preliminary designs for a PFAS treatment system. And at this time, the project was also submitted, very proactively submitted to the Wisconsin DNR Safe Drinking Water Loan Program for potential public funding. Again, that was in 2022, and you know, now we're funding a project in 2025, which is just impressive to really be that far ahead and do all the necessary steps to even get to that point. And then in 2022, we also conducted two separate public meetings and an open house in which all interested members of the public were encouraged to provide input, which they did. We actually gave, I think, five options for different treatment, designs and things like that, and you know, what the different implications would be as far as water quality and cost and all the different factors. And we actually used the public was actually able to inform what we went with, which is this hybrid kind of GAC and IX system that we have. And then finally in 2023, planning and finalization of designs and preparation of bid documents, was completed. And then back in 2024, May of 2024, construction groundbreaking. So to see, as I said, to see these tanks in there after all of that and all the different steps from all the different feasibility, first with the groundwater study, figuring out what the source of this PFAS was, to get into the feasibility of some of the different treatment options and things like that, and then having the community meetings and trying to explain this to them, going through all the, getting the a consultant to develop the preliminary designs, and then using our engineers to really, finalize those 30, 60, 90% design and all these different things over an 8-year period to finally get here where we see the tanks inside the building. It's just amazing. So that's why this is such a newsworthy kind of happening and, a long time coming. So of course, this project required a full team effort. Obviously, it's an engineering project that will help our water quality, but it really was a full team effort from conducting the groundwater and feasibility studies to securing funding and necessary capital budgeting to designing and understanding water quality operations and supply implications, and then ensuring the community involvement through public meetings and other communication channels. So again, I guess just lastly, I will say that it really highlights our commitment to providing safe and high quality water to our community and really not cutting any corners at any point going back to 2017 all the way until the project that is expected to be completed, late this summer. So really, really great work by everyone over years and years of work that finally brought us to this moment where we can see them putting the tanks in there and they're finally situated in there. There's really no going back. And even with the new EPA PFAS standards that have not taken effect yet, once this well is back online, there will be no wells throughout our system that would be surpassing that threshold for PFAS. So that really is a very impressive feat, even on a national scale. And I'm sure we will get some national publications and things like that, really wondering, very similar to our lead service replacement program some years ago. So really just always being ahead of the curve. It's just great to see. And like I said, it took a full team effort, all 130 plus staff, everything that they do on a daily basis to finally get to this point. So that's kind of where we are at this point.
Wow, you made us feel good. Thank you. That was nicely.
Okay. Any questions or comments for Marcus?
Hi. Where is the granulated activated carbon disposed?
That's the number one question that everyone asks. So that's the one kind of mystery. I'm sure Pete Holmgren or Joe Grandy can talk about it, pretty much anyone here. But really, I mean, that is the biggest challenge with this being an emerging contaminant. That is really the one piece of the puzzle that everyone's trying to figure out, because it will be one of the first PFAS treatment systems in the entire state. We don't really know how to dispose of it in the best way to do it. I'm sure Krishna can kind of get to it.
Joe, could you share the planned path forward for disposal of the...
Yeah, so the media can be incinerated. And so what the incineration does is it burns off the PFAS, and then that GAC can be reused, not in drinking water, but it may be in other types of applications. The alternative to that is landfilling. So, and typically that would be landfilling in a more arid environment so that there is less of a risk of groundwater contamination and the release of the potential release of that into the groundwater wherever that is being disposed. So the two disposal options generally are incineration and landfilling.
Have we decided on an option yet?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, so that is the one piece of the puzzle that's still a bit of a mystery.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, in terms of those disposal options, there's a lot of research ongoing in that right now. And so by the time that we need to dispose of the media that we have, it's possible that it's a whole new environment that we're looking at in terms of those disposal options.
Thank you, Mark. When you say the time, sorry, but when you say the timeline for disposal, when would you anticipate that to be?
So for the activated carbon, that has something where that's between 6 and 12 months is likely the life for us. And again, that's going to depend on how much water that we treat and pass through that media. The ion exchange is 3+ years, we anticipate. So the carbon will be replaced more frequently and the ion exchange less frequently.
We definitely would not incinerate on site or even within the city, would we?
There's a huge volume of it and it goes to basically an industrial incinerator. High temperature incinerator typically is going to be necessary for PFAS contaminated waste. And there's just a limited number of sites nationwide for that.
Okay. So if I can just make a comment, I know you guys probably get bored and when we come to the meetings and repeating all of this, but this is so excellent. And like, I'm the alder for District 12. I have almost nothing to do with it, but I do know my constituents and we are the environmentalists. And I know the whole story over time and a lot of you have shared it with me and it is absolutely amazing. And we should be touting that we are the first of any kind in Wisconsin. And every time I talk about it, I feel like I have real bragging, right? So I know it was not an easy path, difficult path, and I appreciate that. And we should be touting it. It is amazing. And I even drink the city water after being on the utilities. Yeah. I'm like, no, it's safe. Drink it. Here, have a glass of water. But I just wanted to say that. I know that you guys get pressure, but that's okay.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, one more. For the Well 15 project, how many tanks and how big are they?
4 tanks, right? Two of each, WGAC, 2 IX. And I mean, I'd say these people are like 6 feet tall, the guy in the red helmet. And I'm sure, I don't know if you guys have an exact dimensions? That
pretty sure it's a 12-foot diameter tank.
The specific dimensions I'm not positive on, but the weight and filtration dimensions are what kind of characterize the treatment. So that's, 20,000 pounds is what is in my mind, like total weight. I think upon delivery, Joe and I were talking about this. They're a little shorter than we originally expected, but performance wise, it's all about the top down kind of filtration and exposure to the media in there. That's really important with the dimensioning of the tanks there. So
is there a volume metric for how much charcoal is in them or how big the tanks are?
There is. I don't have it specifically in front of me, but we've got the specific specs and dimensions of those on file. So
the important factor is that
I can try to pull it up right now.
Yeah, on the project webpage, which I think you probably have seen, because I looked over your shoulder and your phone, not to peek. But Joe Grandy, our water resources manager, his contact is there as a project manager. So, probably reach out, email.
Were you going to say something quick, Joe? Sorry.
No, I was just going to say the critical factor is contact time.
Thank you.
And it's to ensure that there's 10 minutes of contact time as it passes through. That's for the GAC. And then for the ion exchange, it's 3 minutes. And that will be easily achieved in those tanks. We were concerned, not concerned, but surprised by the shortness of the tanks, but we've been reassured by the design engineer that there is sufficient volume to allow for that 10 minutes of contact time.
And then could you say what the 3 minutes was again? I didn't come.
Oh, the 3 minutes is for the ion exchange. So remember, it goes through the carbon first, and then it follows that and goes through the ion exchange. And so we need at least 10 minutes of contact with the carbon and then 3 minutes with the ion exchange.
Okay, well, thank you. And I'm going to move us along a bit, and then we need to approve the reports that we just heard. We generally do that as a collection. So do we have a motion to approve the reports that were presented? Okay, we got a motion to approve and a second.
Second. Who is the motion? I could.
Say aye.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And we're going to do a slight adjustment of the agenda. We have 2 items remaining. We have the meeting evaluation, which Deb will do, and then we're going to do a closed session as posted in the agenda. So we're first going to do the evaluation. So, Deb, if you would do that.
All right. All members actively participate in discussions. All members have opportunities to voice opinions, positions on agenda topics. We met that. Members come prepared to engage in discussion by reviewing materials provided prior to the meeting. We met that. Members engage in active listening and avoid interrupting other speakers. We fully met that. Members offer honest opinions and respect the viewpoints expressed by other members. That was met. Members honor Water Utility Board procedures and policies as outlined in the Water Utility Board policy book. That was met. Members represent the collective interest of current and future Madison residents. At that. And then members make decisions based on equity principles, considering the decision's impact on all residents. The decision-making process considers who benefits, who is burdened, who does not have a voice at the table. How can policymakers mitigate unintended consequences? And I think we keep that in mind and met that.
Okay, thank you. And I have an announcement related to moving us into closed session. It is this, as stated in the meeting notice and agenda, the Water Utility Board will now consider convening in closed session pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 19.85, bracket 1, bracket C, for the next agenda item for the purpose of considering my script has some deletions, over which we will receive some information related to
the item, agendized item.
It's the agenda. The related to 1310 Mendota Street in Madison, Wisconsin, and 1804 South Park Street in Madison, Wisconsin. I now would ask, is there a motion to convene in closed session for this purpose?
So moved.
Okay, and do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Then we are going to move into closed session, and the vote was unanimous, and we are now in closed session.
Thank you.
So.